La réingénierie.
Re-engineering
de Shattuck.
Andrea, you filed a report last week from Sadr City, and there has been a bit of media coverage about the situation in Iraq, primarily focusing on Baghdad, but we've heard from independent media sources that there's a crisis spreading throughout the country, a crisis of violence as the situation erupts there. Can you talk about the general situation in the country and the reaction of people on the ground?
Sure. I'm in Baghdad and I'm not really able to travel out of Baghdad right now particularly much. So I know mostly what's going on in Baghdad, but where, you know, in places like Sadr City, since last Sunday, heavy fighting has taken place in Shia areas between the Al-Mahdi army, which is the army that follows Muqtada al-Sadr, a radical Shiite cleric here, and they've been fighting occupation forces after occupation forces. First shut down the Al-Hawza newspaper, which is Muqtada al-Sadr's newspaper, and then when there were protests against its shutting down, shot into an unarmed crowd of demonstrators, and then arrested one of Muqtada's aides. And so this has set off a wave of fighting and resistance, and the reason it's been covered so much is that in some ways it is the first overt manifestation of uprising among the Shia community, certainly in Baghdad, against the occupation. The Shia haven't been particularly, have not been as anti-occupation as perhaps the anti-war movement or the anti-occupation movement would have liked. It would have made it maybe easier for us to keep our line had they been more up in arms, so to speak, earlier. But of course, they were their majority communities in Iraq, and they're the people who were in many ways most oppressed, most impoverished, most disenfranchised by Saddam's regime. And, you know, therefore, many people will say that, many Shia people here will say that they were in fact very relieved when American troops entered and Saddam was kicked out of power here. So in places like Sadr City this week, I did manage to get there a couple of times, and although there was no official curfew imposed, it did seem that the U.S. Army had occupied all the police stations, were stationed at both ends of at least one main street, and had made it a practice from reports that we could tell of shooting at cars and that people that were moving after dark. So although there was no actual curfew imposed, people were living in a state of terror because they knew that if they were out too late, they could well be shot at while moving in the car. A number of people, at least six people, were killed that way on Tuesday night, for example. We were there on Wednesday morning. And then there's also the terrorization that takes place throughout the night as fighting goes on in the streets between the Al-Mahdi army and occupation forces. And houses are targeted, rockets are launched from American helicopters into houses. Visited one house where, you know, two walls had been destroyed, a gas tank had been set on fire by rockets shot out of helicopters, and then there's machine gun fire, etc. So people are living in that sort of state of fear in Sadr City and in other neighborhoods in Baghdad, not only Shia neighborhoods, I should add, Ayanian, which is, you know, a notoriously Sunni neighborhood, was also the site of heavy U.S. occupation attacks this week. Then outside the city, in Fallujah, in Ramadi, Fallujah has been a point of resistance, of armed resistance, since the occupation began. And this week is facing heavy, heavy attacks from U.S. occupation troops. It was under siege for at least 3 days, I believe. The last report I heard, there was a column of people, reportedly 13 kilometers long, trying to leave Fallujah to get to Baghdad. In Fallujah, over 300 people have reportedly been killed by U.S. occupation forces in fighting, and hospitals until yesterday weren't receiving any medical supplies and they were calling for medical aid. as I understand it, that situation has been alleviated somewhat, but obviously there aren't enough supplies or enough doctors or enough facilities to deal with that crisis, particularly when, you know, reports of U.S. snipers firing on helicopters. And so there's ongoing street battles between, armed militias there and the U.S. occupying forces there. And I imagine that's continuing tonight. And then, of course, in the south, in Basra, in Kut, and also in Nablus, in Kufa, there are reports that there's ongoing fighting between the army and other militias and occupation forces. And the CPA negotiated with Muqtada al-Sadr and were negotiating some sort of a ceasefire in Najaf and in other Shia areas in the south. And then, you know, a couple of hours later, the report was, well, that in fact the U.S. troops had tried to arrest Muqtada al-Sadr on an arrest warrant, an outstanding arrest warrant, and that there had been a gun battle on the road, you know, on the way to Baghdad. And so it's unclear what is going on, and it's particularly unclear what the U.S. strategy in all of this is, except to create a tremendous mess and to continue terrorizing Iraqi people. So that's the situation here. And then I guess you're also asking what the feeling on the ground is. Well, I guess it's obvious that the feeling on the ground is primarily for people in the street. If people aren't sure what's going on or what's going to happen, there's also a sense of resignation. Iraq has been a country at war for the better part of the past 25 years, and you know, it's been under a dictatorship for 35 years and a different sort of dictatorship now for the past year. And so in some ways people just shrug and look off into the distance and say, this is Iraq, this is war again, this is the same thing, here we go again. And that means that there's a response from NGOs and humanitarian organizations who are seriously considering leaving if they haven't already decided to do that. So in the next few days, I think we can see an exodus of foreigners from Iraq, which also sends a message to the Iraqi people, of course. And so UNICEF now, I noticed, had blocked a lot where their entrance used to be. And so it was a sort of symbol of what's going on here, because we were driving past the UNICEF office and the blast wall went up and we noticed that. And then we were trying to get down one road and we couldn't make it down because there was barbed wire spread across the road. It was sort of a new roadblock. And the person who was driving, who is a 22-year-old who has lived in Sadr City and all his life and, you know, has in that sense suffered the worst of what the Ba'athist regime and Saddam's regime meant here, and now is suffering yet again under this occupation and the war that of terror that it's continuing to perpetrate here. He just looked at me and laughed and was like, "Yep, that's Iraq, it's another dead end," you know. And so that is sort of, I think, the feeling of people here. It's fairly hopeless in a lot of ways.
And at the same time, Andrea, you have people here in North America who are so directly implicated in the current life situation of many Iraqis, as the governments here have spearheaded much of the activity there, the activity that is now bringing so much of a crisis to Iraqis. Here in Montreal, there's been a number of demonstrations called because of the ongoing crisis. Tomorrow, there will be a demonstration out in front of the U.S. consulate called once again, this one at 1 p.m., hosted and called for by the Canadian Muslim Forum. That's again 1 p.m. tomorrow at the U.S. consulate. In terms of the ongoing efforts on the ground in Iraq to live through and survive the prison-like system, the lockdown, the clampdown, the crisis, the ongoing violence, where are people sort of at with regard to the ongoing occupation? Is it moving on? Is the perception and thus the action and the resistance, are we now moving towards resisting a war and out of an occupation?
You know, it was funny. I don't know how people feel about that, to be honest. I think some people, depending on where you live in Iraq, you may have experienced the past year as that sort of war all the way along. And we also know that war is poverty. Poverty is war. Lack of education is war. No potable water is war. You know, inadequate food and nutrition is also war. And these are things a lot of people have been living with for the past year, for many years before. And so in that sense, the war is ongoing. But in another sense, to me, not having lived in a war zone, it definitely feels like it has entered a different phase, that this is now a country at war. And I was laughing today at a website I saw. I forget what news agency it was, but, you know, a year ago almost today, we were told that the war was over. The statue of Saddam Hussein in Sardar Square was toppled. Liberty had come to Iraq, and the war was over. And then, you know, the anti-war movement became the anti-occupation movement. And, you know, some people were still talking about the war on terror that was being perpetrated through this occupation, but for the most part, the war was over, and the media chants were saying the war was over. Today, I noticed that one of the headlines was that after a year at war, this had been the heaviest week of casualties. And I was like, well, isn't that telling that suddenly now we're admitting that we've been at war, or that we've been at war for a year, and that this war is an ongoing war? And I think that's the case. I think, sure, the fighting is now different. There's many people, many sides fighting this war, and fighting with RPG-7s and fighting with Kalashnikovs and machine guns and fighting with tanks and with helicopters. But the war is ongoing, and the war has been ongoing, and the war will continue for as long as governments with agendas that involve money and that involve power rule people's lives and perpetrate their own interests in the interests of elites in various countries around the globe, and in ways that the people of Sadr City, for the most part, have absolutely no control over.
Andre, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us.
Thank you, Greg.